I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about some killers in this state's and this country's rivers and streams, Lowhead Dams. They were the subject of a WFYI documentary that aired recently titled Over, Under, Gone. We'll discuss what makes these dams so deadly and what can be done about them. My guests are Manuela Johnson, an administrator with the State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security, Ken Smith, who's with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Division of Water, and Lieutenant Colonel Terry Heineman, Indiana Department of Natural Resources Law Enforcement Division. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the dangers of Lowhead Dams. The inspiration for this conversation is a WFYI documentary called Over, Under, Gone that is re-airing this Thursday evening at 9 p.m. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. And if you do tune in and watch the documentary at 9, you're going to actually be able to place faces with three of the people that we're talking with today. They are, my guests are Manuela Johnson. She is Administrator, State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Ken Smith, he's with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Division of Water, and Lieutenant Colonel Terry Heineman. He is Indiana Department of Natural Resources Law Enforcement Division, and they're all members of the Indiana Silver Jackets Lowhead Dams Initiative team. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. We probably ought to talk about this, and I should say I've seen the documentary I learned a lot from it. Even though it's a fairly somber subject, while enjoying the watching, it's well made and informative. But we probably ought to start, for those who are not initiated in this subject, by talking about what a Lowhead Dam is, what it means. Ken, everybody's looking in your direction, so I guess that means you're up.
When I'd start to explain Lowhead Dams, I'd back up and kind of look at the bigger picture of dam safety. In the nation, I think most of us watched a few weeks ago what was going on in California at the Oroville Dam. That's more the traditional sort of situation, what I'd call safety of dams, that people think about when they think of dam safety. Lowhead dams are much smaller structures than that. Instead of being a large thing that spans a valley and holds back water, a lowhead dam is really more of an obstruction within the stream channel, something that does not pool water up above the natural stream banks, but is just a low obstruction in the channel. And the real issue there is not the safety of the dam. Should one of these lowheads fail and go away, there isn't a large flood wave that goes downstream. The issue is really safety at the dam, the recreational safety aspect of people that might be boating or fishing or recreating in the stream above or below it. These are smaller structures with an entirely different set of issues than that traditional safety of dams topic.
So we're talking about something that is much lower to the ground. You know, most people, when they think of a dam, think of the Hoover Dam or something.
Correct.
Like that. You look like you could parachute off of, basically, and it would be you would need a parachute to go off of it anyhow. These are things that, in some places they're almost hidden in the stream. You wouldn't be aware of them if you were kayaking or canoeing, almost until you were on top of them. Terry, I see you nodding your head, so I'm going to go.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest hazards about lowhead dams is the fact that when you are, as you said, paddling downstream and you're still up above the lowhead dam, because the water flows smoothly over the top of it, you don't actually see the dam until you're ready to go over the top of it. And once you go over the face of the dam, then the recirculation of the water at the bottom is what ends up pinning people against the face of the dam and in most cases eventually drowns them.
We'll get to that in a moment. Manuela, how many of these low head dams are there in Indiana?
There are a little bit over 150 dams in the state of Indiana that are considered low head dams, and they're scattered everywhere. They were a real important part to our history because many of them served as the power source for mills and water diversion for water supplies.
Are they in one particular part of the state, or are they all over?
They are all over the state.
Okay. And just to give Ken, if I could bring it back to you real quickly, to give an idea, are there like spatial dimensions or whatever that define what is a low head dam? Does it have to be less than 10 feet, 12 feet high? Or?
I've always tried to avoid pinning a specific number to what a low head dam is. Because I think you could unintentionally exclude some structures with a definition. The one that really jumps to my mind is the Williams Dam down in the southern part of the state. If you start thinking of heights of 5 to 10 feet, well, Williams Dam, which, Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's like about 30 feet high.
Right.
In my mind, that one is still a low head dam because of the site that it sits at. There is so much drainage area above the Williams Dam. There is so much water that flows down. Even though it's 30 feet high, it behaves much like a low head dam. The downstream area during large floods can virtually drown out to the point that during the flood wave, you almost can't see that this dam is there. And therefore, the hazard, the risk that recirculating currents below the dam is hidden just as if this were a smaller dam, a 10-foot-high dam, on a different stream with less of a drainage area.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about low-head dams and the dangers that they present in anticipation of the re-airing of the WFYI documentary Over Undergone this Thursday evening at 9 p.m. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Terry, what is it that makes these dams so dangerous? And I realize that you're at a disadvantage with the documentary. There are all kinds of clever graphics and pictures to illustrate this. We got to talk it through. So.
Sure. There's two things that make them extremely dangerous. The first is that people underestimate them. When people see a low-head dam, it looks like something that's soothing. It looks like it's something that is enjoyable to play on. And so you got to get past the conception at first. But what makes them extremely dangerous is as the water goes over the face of the dam, it picks up its velocity. And as it hits the water underneath, it shoves that water down. And then as it hits the bottom and wants to start to go downstream, instead it will come back up and recirculate against itself, almost like a washing machine. The water is typically very aerated, which makes it hard for boats to be able to boat through or people to be able to swim through. And then just that grasp as that water continues to try to backfill the void of the water that went over the face of it, just continually tumbles a person around and around and around. Even with a life jacket on, it'll push you down 10, 15, 20 feet below. But when it pops you up, it grabs you again and again drags you back to the face of the dam. So it's just a never-ending cycle. And again, the overwhelming majority of people that get into the face of a low-head dam end up drowning.
Ken.
Kind of adding to what Terry said there, what makes that particularly dangerous with many of these dams is that the nature of these dams changes depending on the amount of flow coming down during a flood event or a non-flood event. We refer to them as being sort of deceitful structures. Mm-hmm. You can go out on a pretty sunny day when it hasn't rained for a week And the dams can be very inviting, and in fact, they aren't particularly dangerous. The flow over the dam isn't a lot. It's not recirculating quickly mm-hmm. below it. But overnight, the next day you go out, after just having had a nice experience recreating there, the next day you go out, it can be an entire different animal with the revolving currents, Terry explained, really active, and the water really turning over behind that boil line just because it rained the night before somewhere up in the watershed. And that deceitfulness of these structures, I think, is what catches a lot of people by surprise.
Well, that was one of the things I noticed in watching the documentary, is you'd see a lot of these dams and think, well, that shouldn't be that. You ought to be able to just scoot right over that. Because in some cases, we're talking about maybe a 2 or 3 foot drop. But it is that recirculating thing that makes it so deadly. And they are deadly, right, Manuel? I mean, how many, one of the things in the documentary that was effective is when there's sort of a roll call of the names of people whose lives have been claimed by this. How many people in this state have fallen victim to Lowhead Dams?
In the past 20 years, we've had 24 people who have died and almost 60 people who have been trapped in a Lowhead Dam and had to be rescued. Many of them were injured as well. And those injuries can range anywhere from a bruise to a brain injury because of lack of oxygen. And that's really the challenge that we have, is so many of the people who have died actually went in to rescue someone else and ended up succumbing to the powers of the water.
What are the most dangerous ones here in the state? Are the ones particularly that people ought to avoid? I feel like, Terry, you looked at me. You made the mistake. I can always tell when it's like a classroom and people are avoiding eye contact. That's a question they don't want to answer.
Sure. We have certain dams, but as Manuela said earlier, they're spread all across the state. Williams Dam, is, as Ken mentioned earlier, is certainly one of the most dangerous dams in the state. But because of that, people recognize that and maybe give it a little bit more breath and stay away from it. The dam in Edinburgh has certainly claimed several lives. There are three dams down in the Corridon area that have claim multiple lives, as has the dam down in Milltown, down in Crawford County, has also claimed multiple lives. So there's a variety of them all across the state that have ended up having multiple people lose their lives from them.
Manuela.
Another particular one that your listeners will all be fairly informed about is the 16th Street Dam, which is also known as Emmerichsville Dam. It has claimed a number of lives, partly because it's right there in the middle of the city and people see it every day and don't think about the hazard that's associated with the dam.
And are there things that, are these dams marked so that if you are out on a kayak or a canoe, you're even aware that you are approaching them?
Most are not well marked. There is no national regulatory arm out there that tells us how to mark them. And so each state, each community has basically been on their own. And some markings are just not very visible when they are marked. They're way too small. They're too close into the dam. And by the time people see the sign, it's too late.
Terry, are there any laws actually that would prevent people? I mean, I see you've got a badge and all sorts of official. But is there anything you can do to stop someone if you see them out on a river and they're about to go over a Lowhead Dam?
No, there's really not. And as Manuela said, we don't have any laws. We don't have any regulations that prohibit somebody from being on dams or being around dams. A lot of them are private property, so you might be able to stretch a trespassing law. But to be honest, we don't know who the majority of the owners are. And then in addition, as was mentioned earlier, marking the dams is very difficult because most of the rivers fluctuate so much in depth that if you put signs up and the water comes up, suddenly your signs are underwater. Some of the rivers that don't fluctuate as much, such as the St. Joseph River up in South Bend, South Bend and Mishawaka has gotten very proactive in putting barrels and cables across the dam to give people advanced warning that they're getting close to a dam and to give them something to grab hold of should their boat break down. But that's the exception, not the rule.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the dangers of low-head dams in anticipation of the re-airing of a WFYI documentary on the subject called Over Undergone. That's going to be showing again on Thursday evening at 9 p.m. My guests are Manuela Johnson. She is Administrator, State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Ken Smith, who's with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Division of Water. And Lieutenant Colonel Terry Hindman. He is with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Law Enforcement Division. They're all members of the Indiana Silver Jackets Lowhead Dams Initiative Team. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the dangers of low-head dams today on No Limits in anticipation of the re-airing of Over Undergone. It's a WFYI documentary on the subject that will be airing again Thursday evening at 9 p.m. My guests are Manuela Johnson. She is Administrator, State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Ken Smith, he's with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Division of Water. And Lieutenant Colonel Terry Hindman, Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Law Enforcement Division. They're all members of the Indiana Silver Jackets Lowhead Dams Initiative Team. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email, as a listener named Jerry has done, at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Jerry has written, what do your panelists think about the possibility of turning some of these dangerous Indiana dams into useful hydroelectric power sources? Ken, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, we've already mentioned one of the dams in particular, the Williams Dam on the White River in southern part of the state. That one is a dam that is actually owned by the DNR itself. And recently, contracts have been signed where we have partnered with a power company to start producing electric power there at that dam again. It had actually been a power company dam back from the 1920s. I believe it was in the 1960s when the power units were shut down. So some of those larger structures are being reverted back to that. Many of them, however, relate back to the time they were just a mill structure, you know, like a power water mill type of thing. And a lot of them have sufficient head on them to really be able to convert easily in order to create the kind of power that would justify the cost of it.
Do most of these dams, you answered the question by citing the exception rather than the rule, right, with these things. Do most of them serve any useful purpose at this point? Manuela, you're shaking your head. Silence doesn't work well on radio. We actually have to use words.
No, actually, they currently do not serve a purpose other than being a potentially historic structure. In many cases, community members just simply love the water falling over the top of them and find them to be picturesque and therefore something they want to keep around, not realizing that it can be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that's sitting in their backyard.
We probably ought to emphasize, Indiana is not the only state in the country that has this problem, right, Ken?
Absolutely correct. It's a problem that is nationwide. About a year ago, Manuela and I were invited down to talk to some people in Kentucky, a little town called Cynthiana, and they had a particular low-head dam in the stream that had killed more than 20 people over about a 20-year history. And there was a local first responder there that was really trying to engage the community in discussions about the future of these dams. and dealing with the, with their particular one. But this problem really is nationwide. There's a website and a study, some people at Brigham Young University, that have documented in excess of 400 deaths in the nation. In all states, the problem seems to exist.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the dangers that low-head dams present. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Tab has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Tab, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was curious about, are there, you know, aquatic species in the streams and rivers that are affected by low-head dams?
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Sure.
Yeah,
there's there's a lot of aquatic species, and one of the things that Dr. Jerry Sweeten, who is a professor up at Manchester College in northern Indiana, did in removing some of the dams in the Eel River, he got very involved in looking at the mussel population. What most people would call clams, and Indiana has a variety of them. Several of them are federally endangered. And so there was a big concern about whether taking dams out would affect mussel beds or not. And actually what we saw was there was no negative effect, but there was actually a positive effect because it opened up the waterway to allow more species of fish and invertebrates to make their way up and downstream. So it's really been a positive factor on all the waterways up to this point that we're aware of.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that for most aquatic life forms, being hurled over a structure and downward is actually really conducive to their health, Manuela.
Most of them just, it's like a giant blockade. And so the genetics remain isolated for that one area. And you actually limit the number of species in the area because of the amount of air that is entrained into the water at the location just below the dam and the low oxygen levels that may be upstream of the dam. By taking the low-head dam out, they actually make a healthier environment and increase the number of species as well as the overall number of fish that are moving through the area.
And let me boil this down. In a state where, you know, a significant portion of the population loves to hunt and fish, would getting rid of low-head dams make the fishing better or worse?
It'll make the fishing better over a much broader area, but you'll have several fishermen who will argue against that because they love to know that if they fish right at the face of the dam, the fish can't get away. They can't go any further upstream than what the dam is. So a lot of times they'll concentrate at the base of a dam. But research has shown that as those dams are removed, the fisheries population spreads out and it actually makes it a healthier population, as Manuela was saying. And the fish actually improve. So fishermen should support it, even though I understand they think if the fish are trapped here, it makes for better fishing, but that's not necessarily true.
Again, we are talking about the dangers of low-head dams in anticipation of the re-airing of the WFYI documentary Over Under Gone this Thursday evening at 9 p.m. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named David has done and call us at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
You guys talked about how people easily get caught in the water being churned over and over. Is there any kind of suggestion as to how to get out? Like maybe when it pushes you down, try to go forward out underneath the current before it turns you over again? Is there some kind of suggestion for how to get out of the washing machine effect, as you called it earlier?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, David. Terry, I think that's you.
Sure. Thank you, David. And you bring up a very good point. There is what is called in theory an escape route, which is clear down against the bottom of the riverbed. And we teach people that if you are caught every time that you get pushed to the bottom, and typically the water will hit you with enough force, it'll push you to the bottom. If you can grab hold of the bottom and pull yourself away from the face of the dam. That's where the resistance is the least amount, and that gives you a good probability of possibly being able to pull yourself out. The other thing that you need to keep in mind is as you get surfaced or brought back up to the surface, instead of trying to swim away from the face of the dam, swim parallel to the face of the dam towards the shoreline, realizing that you're only going to get a few strokes in, going to have to catch your breath, and it's going to push you back underwater again. But if you can make it over to the shoreline, then a lot of times there's obstructions and things there that you can grab hold of and hold on until professional rescue help can get there.
Is there, you know, when you say that in theory there's an escape route at the bottom, this assumes, of course, that the bottom is not, you know, so deep that you really don't have much hope of getting back up. Is it something, I mean, do you need to grab onto the bottom, or if you are a reasonably strong swimmer, is it something you could pull yourself?
No, the strong swimmer is not going to help you at all.
Okay.
It's really going to probably, to be honest, be more about luck. I was down at Williams Dam when we lost one of our officers, and one of our other officers actually got recirculated four different times before he got what we called spit out of the dam. In other words, he hit the bottom hard enough that the current actually shoved him out, but not until after being shoved down about 25 feet underwater each of the times that he got recirculated. So we know it can work, but so many times, as Ken could tell you, the bottom is absolutely littered with rebar and blocks of concrete from when they made the dam. There's a lot of dead trees and stuff that have come over the dam. And so there's so many hazards there that I caution to tell people to try that. But it is something that we know does work. It just doesn't work very often.
Ken?
And I'd suspect somebody that has been recirculated a time or two is going to become very disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
It would be hard to know for sure you were at the bottom. It would be hard to know for sure which direction to even go when you're there. Really, the best thing to do is to try to avoid being in this situation to begin with. And,
yeah.
And I hope that's the message that people hear and that people then start to teach younger children, or whether it's parents or grandparents, teach the youth. To try to avoid these things, especially after a rain event, because they are so dangerous, they just need to stay away from them. The one number we haven't tossed out yet was the average age of people that are dying at these dams are very young people, people in their 20s. And that means there's a particular segment of our population we need to reach with this message. And the best way I can think of doing that is parents and grandparents talking to their kids in springtime like this. They're going to want to be out playing at streams and doing things, and they need to be aware of the danger.
The people who have died, these young people who have died, is it typically kayaking, canoeing, tubing, those kinds of things, or
it can be a myriad of things, but most of them are actually fishermen, swimmers, kayakers, canoers, boaters. If you'll remember, just not too many years ago in Indianapolis at Broad Ripple, a family of five ended up in a boat that lost power to their motor. Had no intention of being near the dam, but because of the loss of the power from the motor, ended up going over the dam and oddly ended up in a precarious situation where they had to remove them using a helicopter. We almost lost an entire family of five. Three generations were in that boat.
And I think one of the important things to also point out, John, is an awful lot of the people that drowned at Lowhead Dams are people trying to rescue people who are caught in Lowhead Dams. And I would like to encourage all your listeners that if they see somebody that is caught in a Lowhead Dam, the best thing they can do is call 911. And then shout encouragement to give that person that's trapped in that situation some mental fortitude that there is help coming. And But if they jump in to try to save somebody, we're simply going to have two drownings instead of one.
Yeah, I know from my days as long, long ago, I put myself through high school and college by lifeguarding, that, you know, entering the water is supposed to be your last option there, that you're not supposed to go in to try. If you can throw something, if you can,
right,
if you can row out to it, you're supposed to do that. If you have a way to, you know, reach an oar out or something like that, is that a safe technique for trying
sure.
to remove someone from that situation? You want to make sure you're braced, though, pretty well, because
right.
you could get pulled in.
Absolutely. The force of the power of moving water is unlike anything most people have experienced. So you do need to be braced. You need to have your center of gravity low, and you need to, if you're reaching out, don't lean out over the water. If you throw something, lean back away from the water once the person grabs hold of it, because there will be a huge tug on the end of that rope. And as you said, just don't get in. Even after teaching at the Indiana River Rescue School for almost 20 years, one of the things that I can tell you is even professional rescuers, if they see that the victim is a child, a woman, or a coworker, they will almost always jump in. And this is even people who are trained to know the hazards of the dam. So the general public, not knowing the risk of the dam, there's even a higher percentage of people that will jump in.
So let's assume, though, you're out canoeing or kayaking or tubing, and suddenly you realize, oh, there's one of these things dead ahead of me. And, you know, particularly if you're not really, really skilled at this, what should you do?
I'd say start paddling upstream like your life depends on it, because it does.
And okay. and try to angle towards the bank.
Right.
Yeah. Get yourself out. Get onto something at the bank, even if that means you've got to let your boat go and,
okay.
And the boat go over the dam by itself. Get yourself out.
That's part of where I was going with this, is do you leave the, you know, the kayak or the canoe behind and just go overboard to try to get to? Terry, you're nodding your head.
It all depends on the circumstances and the situation, because one of the things that you got to remember is everybody has a different strength and swimming skill. You talked, John, about being a lifeguard, and because you're a lifeguard, you're very confident in your swimming ability.
Well, not when I got tons of water being dropped on me. But,
right.
yeah.
But before you go over the dam, you might opt, yeah. if your swimming ability is better than your paddling ability, to get out of the watercraft that you're in. Most of the time, you can usually get that watercraft with, if you got two people in there, over to shore quicker than what you could swim. But you've just got to look at each circumstance as it arises.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the dangers of low head dams in anticipation of the rebroadcast of the WFYI documentary this Thursday evening at 9, Over, Under, Gone. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. So if you, the best and most practical, because we're going to move pretty quickly to, you know, the more global parts of this problem. If you are approaching one of these things, avoid it at all costs is the safety tip. And then beyond that, if you have to go overboard, if you go over one of these things, Terry, real quickly, what should people do? Because I think this is important. It could save a life.
Absolutely. If people go over, the first thing that you got to do is get your mental faculties to where you know which direction to go. Swim towards the closest shore as rapidly as possible. Be prepared to be shoved underwater. And each time that you come back up, grab another big bite of air, and again, swim towards the shore as fast as possible.
We are talking about the dangers of low head dams here on No Limits. WFYI has done a documentary on this subject called Over, Under, Gone that is going to air again this Thursday evening at 9 p.m. My guests are Manuela Johnson. She is Administrator, State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Ken Smith, who is with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Division of Water, and Lieutenant Colonel Terry Heineman, Indiana Department of Natural Resources Law Enforcement Division. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the dangers of low head dams. In anticipation of the re-airing of the WFYI documentary on the subject called Over Undergone, that program will air again Thursday evening at 9. My guests are Manuela Johnson. She is administrator of the State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security, Ken Smith with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Division of Water, and Lieutenant Colonel Terry Heineman. He's with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Law Enforcement Division. They're all members of the Indiana Silver Jackets Low Head Dams Initiative team. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Lori has done and reach out to us via Facebook. You can find us at No Limits WFYI. Lori writes, has there been any research into altering the structure of the existing dams by changing the way the water falls over them, as opposed to removing them for those communities that are resistant? Manuela.
There are a number of efforts out there. One of the items they call a rock ramp, where rocks, very large rocks, can be placed in front of the face of the dam to try and break the hydraulic. The challenge is that that has to be maintained on a regular basis.
Ken, I'm sorry, you were looking like you wanted to jump in.
And in addition, it's still a danger when it's there. Mm-hmm. The person that's going over that is going over rock and still could be injured, but at least the hydraulic wouldn't be there. That drowning mechanism wouldn't be in place. But it certainly is something looked at, because some of these dams, no matter how much they probably need to go away, can't for a certain reason. Maybe they're used for water withdrawal for agricultural purposes or for a community. So many of them can't just go away. They need to be altered.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the dangers that low head dams present. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Phil has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Great show.
Thanks much. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a fairly avid canoeist on my stream. I do a lot of long distance stuff, Indianapolis to Green or Petersburg and stuff like that. And I try to be responsible, buy maps, locate these low head dams. And yet there was an instance where we knew we were close, but we almost didn't see it in time. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of process or thing in place where they can start putting signage upstream for these things so people who are using the waterways know that they're there.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Terry.
Actually, the Silver Jackets Initiative has been working very hard on that. We've developed a sign that gives people advance warning of low head dams in the area and the fact that they do pose a danger to people. The problem that we're running into is, as with anything else, getting the funding to pay for the signage, getting permission of private landowners to put the signage up, and then having to maintain the signs once the signs are put up after securing permission. So, yes, there is a lot of discussion. We've taken the steps of getting a very nice template that we can put out there to communities. But it's like anything else, getting the funding to be able to afford to put it up at 150-plus dams.
Ken.
And it comes back to the heart of the issue here, that the three of us that are sitting here, Manuel and Terry and I, we're all pretty much volunteers working this initiative. There is not a program in place. There isn't a government entity either in this state or really in any states nationwide who have been charged with the mission of safety at dams. So not only is there no funding for signs, there's really nobody that is a responsible one single source point within governments in order to do things like that, which brings us back to we volunteered because as professionals we know it's something that concerns us and we're trying to do what can be done with the resources we have with the hope that maybe one of the most important pieces is just to raise awareness and education on the topic. Now, interestingly, the notion of something to warn people when they're near one of these, one of our partners, the U.S. Geological Survey, has been working with a smartphone app recently, trying to create a mechanism with a smartphone app that has locations of these structures that we know of in the app, so that when an individual would get near them within a certain distance, they would basically get a message, a vibration, as something from their phone pointing out that there's something in their area.
Something coming up.
But still, right. It's a volunteer initiative trying to pull this together.
Well, and it takes an awful lot of time and effort, I would think, just to catalog where these things are and then connect them with the GPS and all of that that would do this. We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named Paul. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI on Facebook. Paul writes, hey, don't forget to mention the importance of life jackets when playing around water. Thanks so much. Terry, preaching to the choir here.
Absolutely. If you don't wear it, it's not going to help you. So, we find the overwhelming majority of all water fatalities are people who are not wearing life jackets, and somebody that has a minor injury, what we would consider a minor injury on a roadway, such as a broken leg or a broken arm, becomes a fatal injury in the water because they suddenly can't keep themselves above water if they're not wearing a life jacket. So I appreciate Paul saying that. That's a great tip.
Would a life jacket help you in this disastrous situation we've talked about where you're trapped in kind of this spinning vortex of
It will not
water.
Keep you on the surface. We wear life jackets when we're doing professional rescue work that has the most buoyancy manufactured. They're specifically made for fast water rescue. And the officer I was talking about earlier, he was recirculated clear to the bottom multiple times, even though he was wearing a life jacket. But it does lend you a little bit of support when you get back up to the surface.
The water that is in this boil area is heavily aerated. It's filled with bubbles. So it does not provide flotation the way people are used to with water. And that's really the problem. Even with the life jacket, you're working kind of against the forces of nature. Mm-hmm. That water just isn't going to lift you up in the jacket the way it would in a still water setting.
Gotten an email from a listener named Tracy, and if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Tracy writes, how can local individuals work to champion removal or modification to make a low head dam safer? Manuela.
Well, one of the ways is by getting together with the other community members and working with those communities, identify the owner, and then work with the owner to come to the Department of Natural Resources. There are a number of permits that are needed for that, and we have one excellent champion out there who will gladly teach other people about that, and that is Dr. Jerry Sweeten. In addition, there is a group called the Polaris Project out there in Fort Wayne. The parents of Sean Hebel, who died in 2016, and actually 2015, I'm sorry, and they are actually helping people who want to champion the removal of low head dams. And Polaris Project has both a Facebook page as well as a Twitter handle.
You've mentioned a couple of times that it's often difficult to find out who owns these low head dams. Part of the reason, I would guess, is because the owners do not want to acknowledge the liability associated.
Definitely.
With this. There has to be a way to trace it back, though, to something. Ken, you're shaking your head.
A lot of these structures are so old. They may be 100 years old or 150 years old, tied back to sort of the dawn of history in the state with old mill structures. And through time, when you start looking at deeds of properties on either side, mention of the dam structure just seems to get lost in time, so that there really is not, for generations back, any real clear indication of who owns these structures.
Well, let me ask this then. Suppose I were to discover, and I should emphasize, this is not the case, that I own some property at which one of these low head dams is, and I've been listening to this program, and I think, oh, no, I want to get rid of that if I can. Is there any state aid or a state program that would help me do that, Manuela?
There are state grant programs out there. The Rivers and Lakes Enhancement Program actually has funds. The Department of Environmental Management has some river restoration funds as well. So it would be in the individual's best interest to get a hold of an engineering group who is familiar with dam and dam removal, and they can help them work through the various permits and funding organizations.
Ken.
But back to the question that was asked, and it was a very good question. Finding a person, a group, an entity that wants to be a local champion and work on taking these structures out, that's a very important piece. Our initiative group has identified at least 12 different dams and local champions that we're aware of. We're trying to provide moral support, if we can, and technical advice, that are working on the issues of taking some of these structures out. The most recent one I can think of that's been successful was the one in Huntington, where local entities in that community, I think it was actually a town official, knew that they needed to take care of one of these dams and get it removed, and really championed their way through the process of helping finding the funding, getting it through the permits, and actually getting the removal construction to occur.
Is there a philanthropic way to do this? I mean, to say in a community, we've decided this is a hazard. We don't, you know, I watched the documentary. I know most of the victims are between age, I think the low end was 10, and then they go all the way up to the mid-20s, and the average age is 20, almost right on the dot. So I don't want to see in my community these young people put at risk like this. Is there a way you can do kind of a speak now or forever hold your peace kind of public effort and say, you know, we can't find out who owns this thing, but we're going to raise the money, we're going to knock it down, you know, unless someone can make a plausible claim otherwise. Is there a process in place in which that can be done? Ken, I see you nodding your head up and down.
Well, the thing I'm really thinking about is in many counties around the state, there are community foundations, groups that work to pull together donations and package them for grants to do things. And those community foundations, I think, could be a great resource for an individual, for a small group of people to reach out to in order to help get some professional leadership on a cause such as removing one of these structures. Interestingly, we mentioned the professor that had himself on the Eel River gotten several of these dams removed, and he found that lack of ownership information fairly helpful because he was able to go to the adjoining properties and say, do you own this dam? And of course, the people said, no, we don't. And would you mind if this dam goes away? Well, at that point, the property owners normally have been supportive. And it's been beneficial that the ownership was unclear.
And if they haven't asserted ownership, they lack standing anyway to challenge.
Yes.
So how much does it cost to remove one of these? I mean, is it a five-figure problem or a six-figure problem? Or
it really depends on the structure and the river that it sits in. If someone were to try to remove Williams Dam, it would be very expensive, very large structure in a very large river. The one at Huntington, I'm trying to remember what the price tag was. I was thinking it was less than $50,000. It very site-specific.
And I think the ones on the Eel River were all between $25,000 and $35,000 that Dr. Sweeten managed to get removed.
So it's more than a notion, but but less than, you know, a massive undertaking.
Pretty cheap. Pretty cheap price to save a life.
Far less than actually modifying the face of the dam. It's actually much more expensive to modify a dam.
And again, I know I asked you this question earlier, Manuela, but I think it bears repeating. Provided that you are no longer running a mill using 19th century technology, is there, or even 18th century technology, probably even go back further than that, is there any reason for these low head dams to exist? Do they serve a purpose?
We have a few out there that are still serving a purpose as a water withdrawal to serve for the water supply for a community. The great majority, however, are not serving a purpose in the state of Indiana, nor throughout the country.
So of the 150 or so that we have right now, how many of them, you know, if you had a magic wand and could make it happen, Ken, would you like to see preserved, and how many would you like to see done away with?
I would say the vast majority of them that I'm aware of probably could go away without affecting a specific thing. Manuela, do you want to try to put a number to it?
I was thinking somewhere in the range of about 30 that are absolutely necessary that we could not pull.
Okay. So 120 of them then could be dispensed with?
100, yeah.
100 to 120 of them?
Right.
Okay, real quickly again, Terry, because safety is the thing. If you have ignored everything else we have said on this program and you find yourself trapped in one of these things, what do you do besides pray?
Well, praying, in my opinion, is yeah. First and foremost. That is the most important thing. But after that, when you're on the surface, swim aggressively towards the closest shore, parallel to the face of the dam. Be mentally prepared to get shoved underwater. When you're underwater, try to grab a hold of the bottom. Pull yourself away from the face if possible. If it shoots you back up to the surface, start swimming for shore again. And just continue that cycle until you either reach the shore or help gets there and can assist you.
Well, I think that probably will have to be the last word. Again, this conversation was inspired by a documentary done by the TV side of WFYI. That documentary is called Over, Under, Gone, and it is going to be re-airing this Thursday evening at 9 p.m. So if you have a fascination or an interest in this, and more important, if you want to know how to keep either you, your children, or your grandchildren safe when they're on a river, it is must-watching. I'd like to thank my guests for an incredibly informative hour. They are Manuela Johnson. She is administrator with the State Disaster Relief Fund, Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Ken Smith, he's with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Division of Water. And Lieutenant Colonel Terry Heineman, Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Law Enforcement Division. Thank you all. I learned a lot talking with you.
Thank you.
Really appreciated having you here. I'd also like to thank our listeners both for some great questions and to invite them to come back on Thursday when we're going to be talking with noted author Thomas Frank about his book, Listen, Liberal. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.